Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. With your hosts, Bo Spearham and Karina Hogan.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we are broadcasting from. I also like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service NIRS, or if you're tuning in via our app, 98.9FM for the best country, which you can download for free from your device, from your app store for your device, or if you're tuning in via our website, 989fm.com.au, because via our website we podcast our program, which you can also catch on Apple Podcast and also Spotify. Those platforms beaming us into your communities. And as always, it is great to have your company. Good morning, Karina.
Good morning.
How you going, sis?
I'm good. I took yesterday off. I'm back. Yes. I'm back better and bigger than ever.
Yes. And you also watched my babies on Friday night.
Oh, I did. We had a really exciting, fun Friday night.
They loved it.
Me and the kids. It was deadly. Loved having them. They're my little baby's cousins.
Yes.
So we, spent a lot of time at the park.
Yes, no, they love the park.
Yeah, love them. The little Bardu and Nalini and my baby Chloe. Yeah, I had a really, really good weekend, actually, lovely weather, and it's still beautiful today. I feel like we need to be out broadcasting out there, which we will be doing tomorrow down on Boundary Street in West End. So if you're in the vicinity, come on down and we'll be broadcasting live from our kiosk down there.
Yes.
And we've got a pretty
exciting But if you do come down and listen to us, we do adhere to social distancing and
100%.
All that stuff.
Really important.
In regards to COVID-19 as well. So keep that in mind, hand sanitizers. As well. But today is Beyond Power and Control.
It is. It is. Our series called Let's Talk Beyond Power and Control looks at various institutions and systems that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are generally overrepresented in, or, you know, systems that impact First Nations people in one way or another. And one of those is the prison industrial system, Bo. And
yes,
we've spoken a lot about this over the last 8 months since we began the series. And it's an interesting yarn because there's so many different discussions that have sort of arisen out of things like COVID, Black Lives Matter rally, all these discussions around black deaths in custody.
Yes.
And we like to confront issues. We like to look at things and look at it critically, you know.
Definitely. And we also, you know, like to, I guess, have a spin on, you know, beyond power control and see how individuals, families and communities are sort of taking that power and control back, whether that's infighting, whether that's fighting, you know, for justice, or that's just sort of, you know, through their own process as well. So it's important that, you know, doing this program that, you know, we sort of acknowledge the amazing work that people are doing, who do come in contact with the justice system.
Yeah, and black fellas that work within the system, black fellas that work against the system. I mean, we all exist in some capacity or another, and there's always a story behind that particular journey. You know, I have my how it is that I look at the criminal quote unquote justice system, and you know, I've had my own experiences and reasonings why I struggle with how that system works against mob. But this program in particular looks particularly at you know, issues that that we can sort of break apart and pull apart. Particularly today, we wanted to talk about over here in Queensland, the Palaszczuk government has pledged a historic boost to police numbers. Now,
yes.
That's interesting. I found that interesting. I mean, you know, given all of this talk that's happening around Black Lives Matter, I don't know whether it is because I live in my own echo chamber. Obviously, I work with women in prison and have been a massive advocate for working against prisons. So I don't know whether it is that I live in my own echo chamber, but when I heard it, I suppose I was a little bit surprised. Was I? A little bit? Oh, I don't know. I just think that, you know, with all the yarns that we've had around the impacts of prisons on First Nations people, but on communities in general, it seems to be falling on deaf ears.
Yeah,
to some degree.
Yeah, it's alarming the amount of money that, you know, the Queensland government is pledging to give the QPS, Queensland Police Service, and maybe this is not actually confirmed, you know, already in the bank account. Maybe this is just sort of a, you know, because I believe it is an election year, you know, in the next couple of months. But, you know, the police commission came out and said this is an historic event, very historic. And it also, you know, I think she was in an article saying that, you know, there weren't this many police, I guess, on the streets of Queensland as there was like 30 years ago.
Mm.
And who was in power 30 years ago?
Joe.
Yes.
Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that your grandfather? no, so I just some basics there about that announcement that that happened on Sunday, the 27th of September. Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk announced a $624 million 5-year investment, which would include 1,450 new frontline enforcers. So today on Let's Talk, we're chatting to two people. Our first guest is Maggie Munn, and she is a fiercely passionate feminist activist, socialist, writer, 90s tragic, and most importantly, a Goongari woman. and she's from South West Queensland, grew up in Toowoomba, and we're going to be yarning to her about her thoughts around the increase of this massive so-called commitment that the Palaszczuk government has pledged. And then later on in the program, we're going to be yarning with Professor Chris Canini, Chris Canine, sorry, who's a professor of criminology at the University of Technology. And he's written an amazing piece in The Conversation called Defunding the Police Could Bring Positive Change in Australia. And he's outlined communities that are showing the way around the world. So we're going to sort of point to those places around the world and get an idea around, you know, how those places are looking at justice reinvestment, alternatives to policing, and all those types of things. So I'm looking forward to yarning to him.
Definitely. And that article was written back pretty much at the height of the Black Lives Matter rallies, but just here in Australia, but around the world as well. Mm. So you can catch on the conversation. And I'm sure if you just type in Chris Canine.
Yep. C-U-N-E-E-N.
Yep. Double N.
Double N, sorry. It comes in C-U-N-N-E-E-N. It comes up for the conversation. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, and I'm going to have our CEO in here as well because he was a CEO back in his day, he worked within the prison system. So
yes, he got me in there to do some stuff as well. So that's where I first met Jai. So he's going to come a little bit later and have a yarn with us as well.
I want to ask him, you know, about, you know, being a black fella working within a system that clearly Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are very much overrepresented. In fact, 27% of the prison population are First Nations people. So, you know, working within that system, how do you do that successfully? You know, are there challenges that face you throughout that process? And also, what are some of the successes and wins that he's had working in the system? You know, has he changed the lives of some of the people that he's worked with or, you know, learnt things, you know? So I'm really looking forward to that yarn. But I think we kick it off with our first guest today, Maggie Nunn. And as I mentioned, she's a fiercely passionate feminist activist, socialist and writer and a Goongari woman. But I'll let you explain to us, Maggie, who's your mob and where are you from?
Yeah, Yawala. As Karina said, I'm Maggie. I grew up on Goongari country out southwest Queensland and in Toowoomba as well on Jarbal and Jarawa country. So shout out to the mob out there.
Awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Definitely shout out to the mob out there in that way as well. There's heaps of
beautiful country out there.
It is. Heaps of my mob. Good Morning Fellas out that way as well.
It's beautiful out
there.
Shout
out to all their mob.
Is that sort of the same as the Bunya Mountains, like sort of area? This is me showing my city side. Here we go.
Bunya's is more,
a bit more north. Yeah. I just remember when I went up there, I drove through Toowoomba.
Yeah, southwest, so like Roma, Mitchell.
Yes, right. Well, shout out to everyone out there. Yeah, it's beautiful out there.
On the way to St. George and stuff.
I'm looking forward to taking the kids out that way for a couple of weeks at the beginning of the school holidays. Can't wait for that. So tell us, you're doing a panel.
Last night
you did a panel. Tell us about that panel that you were part of.
Yeah, so it was run by BRISC and One Woman Project, BRISC being the Brisbane Rape and Incest Survivors Centre, and One Woman Project as well, a feminist organisation. And it was centred around the law reforms that are kind of taking place around the consent laws for sexual violence. Bit of a trigger warning on that.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, we talked about essentially what those reforms are and the process that was involved around consultation and sort of submissions about the changes to that. And we talked about whether or not the fight for abolition of prisons and police can fit alongside this idea of reforming laws. So we had a pretty good conversation. There was a clinical psychologist, a lawyer, a sex worker, and me. It was done over Zoom. There was a couple. Oh, like 70 participants or something like that, which was really good. We had a good chat about those sorts of things. I think from where I stand, I would have liked the conversation to be more about the fight for abolishing the criminal justice quote unquote system, and looking more at alternatives. We had a good chat. So hopefully the listeners took a bit away from it.
Awesome. I guess before we sort of delve in any further as well, I guess in your words, what is abolition?
Yeah, right. So prison abolition and policing abolition essentially looks at getting rid of the system that we currently experience, getting rid of this idea of punishment for crime, and instead kind of imagining and building a better world that looks at more transformative justice. So, defunding, I guess, the police and prisons and starting to build organisations that focus on community care, mutual aid, crisis centres and things like that that sort of address the root causes of a lot of the problems that we experience, rather than punishing people and sending them to prison.
Mm. Like, I've literally only heard that word in the last couple of years. Being involved in sort of activism, over the last few years, sort of heard that word spiked here, there, and everywhere, and then sort of, getting to know sort of Karina and sort of, what Citizens Side does, or like, and sort of other, community people and activists as well, sort of talking.
The word freaks people out
definitely,
sometimes.
How
can you live in a world without prisons?
That's it. Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about that today.
For sure, definitely. So I've just sort of been introduced to that word as well, and like Karine just said, to a lot of us who have grown up, well, essentially everybody in this country or the world has sort of grown up, thinking that the justice system is normal and is just and is sort of something, is as part of the system, as anything else as well.
And then
we hear, the term abolition, mm-hmm. prison abolition, police abolition, and then so that sparks a different conversation, mm-hmm. which needs to happen, but is it happening enough?
Yeah, it's certainly, I encounter that a lot, even from my family, who are, like-minded. And it does, Karina, you're right, it freaks people out when you say things like, let's get rid of the police, because I think as a society we've been conditioned to really believe in this idea of punishment and this idea that there are good people and that there are bad people and that the bad people deserve to be punished. But what that system fails to kind of address and fails to look at is why people do the things that they do and what the environment is that allows for this criminal behaviour to occur, what the conditions are. And, I mean, we as First Nations people, as mob, we know that this system that we currently live in disproportionately targets us, and we know that oftentimes we bear the harshest sentences, the harshest kind of reality of this system. And kind of as far as I'm concerned, any law that's imposed by a colonial system is never going to afford us justice at all.
Mm.
So I think we need to.
I mean, and historically as well, Maggie, it's important to note that this country was founded on settlers that came in, prisoners that came in and sort of built or invaded this country. So
those prisoners on the first fleet.
And yeah, that's it.
How do you feel about the fact that Anastasia Palaszczuk has announced $624 million 5-year investment in policing, which will include, more police beats. It'll include 50 more people in child protection investigation units, 300 in communication centres, 125 liaison officers. and 100 frontline support personnel. How do you feel when you hear this coming from
or even seeing the numbers at the front round?
When that announcement was made, I felt really uncomfortable, to be honest. And when I was reading through the article, I read it when it came out, and I reread it this morning on my way into the studio here. And, you know, I think my reaction was twofold. This article came out and this announcement came out, you know, a couple of days, well, a week after we rallied to support Aunty Sherry's family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have seen a massive increase in awareness raising and demand for accountability with all of the Black Lives Matter stuff that's been happening, you know, both here and abroad. So to come off the back of that and say, oh, well, actually, instead of listening to you and instead of listening to, you know, mob who experienced this firsthand, we're just going to throw more police at the problem. So that felt really on the nose and just inappropriate. But then when I was reading it this morning, I went back through and I kind of was looking for indicators that I guess it of just how wrong it is, really. And I think there was a line in it that said, you know, 1,400 police officers will be deployed to frontline work to target key areas, yeah. Right? And when I read that, key areas, you know that she's talking about, or the article is talking about, predominantly Black areas, you know, or areas occupied by people of colour, you know, our brothers and sisters from the islands, you know, those areas are disproportionately targeted by police. And when we see an overrepresentation of police in those areas, as a result, we see an increased level of arrest, you know, and the statistics on crime then are overreported, and, you know, it shows an increase. But of course, if there are more police there to pick up crime, then of course it's going to reflect to be more. But yeah, those key areas that they talked about, automatically I felt, you know, that's targeting us, really.
It's disconcerting, isn't it? I mean, in 50 in child protection and investigation units, I mean, I almost feel as though there's like a push to kind of attract more so a public opinion than it is to actually attract sense. I mean, I'm interested in yarning with Chris Kinnean later on in the program, who's going to outline different communities that are showing how it is that we can do this differently. I feel like this is almost just like a let's do this quick fix thing that historically is shown has not been effective, unfortunately.
Oh, definitely. You know, if you look for a time when, you know, they've implemented more military or police power anywhere, you know what I mean? You're going to see, you know, an increase in sort of, you know, police brutality. You're going to see an increase in sort of, you know, more violence or whatever towards sort of, you know, these people who are in authority as well, you know. It's disconcerting when, you know, like you just mentioned, you know, and I didn't even think to put those two things into sort of perspective, like not even half in a week ago, you know, if not 5,000 to 6,000 people, you know, gathered in Brisbane and marched back to Musgrave Park, you know, for a very reason to respond to things like this.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you've just joined us here on Let's Talk, we're yarning with Maggie Munn. She is a fiercely passionate feminist, activist, socialist and writer and a Goongari woman. And I just want to know, it's $624 million being, that's the idea that's been put forward by Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk, which will happen over about 5 years and will include 1,450 new frontline officers. What would you do with that $624 million if I handed that to you today?
I definitely would not inject that into the police force at all. I think that $624 million could be much better spent investing in our communities and investing in community care and organisations that are, you know, actually working towards delivering justice for survivors of harm, you know, whether, you know, through whatever ways they're doing that. And I think that's the thing that often gets you know, misunderstood or perhaps intentionally not talked about is that the police, you know, and the justice system is incredibly reactive. You know, you don't, there's no proactivity amongst, you know, the police or prisons or anything like that. They're solely reacting to something after it happens. Now, I'd like to see that $624 million invested in things that can help prevent harm from happening, but also, you know, help people once that harm has occurred. You know, let's get counselling centres, let's get crisis centres, let's, you know, keep kids with their families. Let's not put them through the, you know, through the child protection system. Let's start investing in our
communities. I mean, here's an interesting one. There's incredible pressure on the domestic violence at the moment, especially with COVID-19. Thousands of women have been turned away from domestic service legal centres. In fact, last week it was found that half the vulnerable women seeking legal assistance are getting turned away, with services saying that they need 123 more lawyers and $25 million funding boost to cope with that. I'm just dumbfounded. How much money are you going to put into addressing issues around that are going to come out of COVID-19? You know, that extra pressure that's put on women, you know, who are actual carers that do the frontline work in hospitals, in who cop the bigger brunt of having to teach their children at home, as statistics have shown. So what are we actually doing to invest in those things? Are we just going to pop a police officer in the house and go, hey, look, we're going to deal with the issues around education? Like it just doesn't kind of meld and make sense and link up to me.
No, it doesn't. And we know that it doesn't. You know, domestic violence services and legal services, you know, both for non-Indigenous and Indigenous people have had their funding cut over the last couple of years. You know, so again, it's very on the nose that this $624 million goes straight to police when we have essential services and frontline services
that cut every day.
They're cut. Yeah.
Yeah. And not to mention, like, some of these, this money is going into putting officers in schools as well.
I know that, you know, my children or children that I know from the community that I grow up in could probably do a little bit more with support from a family perspective than a police officer coming in. I mean, and the other thing is, I think that's important to note, is that it's not fair to put that pressure on police officers either. They're not social workers.
No, you know? They're not. But then they, you know, they get treated like it, and they only, you know, they only get trained a certain way. So then their responses are only going to be like a certain way.
At the rally the other week, one of the speakers jumped up and said exactly that. You know, they're not trained doctors, they're not psychologists, they're not, you know, all these
even
things.
Just dealing with domestic violence, we've seen an incredible increase on the number of women as respondents when it comes to domestic violence. Incredible increase. In fact, I believe it's about four times, I'll find the exact statistic, but four times the amount of women are being made respondents on domestic violence orders compared to only 5 years ago. You know, like, that's an incredible increase. So police officers come to these places and they're expected to deal with these situations as though they are trained in this area, and they're not, and it's not fair on them, in all fairness, to put them in that position, you know?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of reminded, last year I went to the shops. I live in Toowong, and I went to the Toowong village to get me groceries with my partner, and as we were walking up, there was a young man who looked like he was going to jump off the building, you know, into sort of the road that leads onto Coronation Drive. So at any given time, it's quite busy. And the security for the building, my partner John and I, we sort of talked him down and tried to get him to stay safe. And the security for the shopping centre called the police. And the police then arrested this man who was obviously quite mentally unwell, and really struggling and in a really dark place. And they handcuffed him and took him to hospital. The man had done nothing wrong, you know, so instead of investing in, you know, services that would have helped that man and responded appropriately they sent a police officer. And we don't know what that fella's trauma is like.
100%.
I've got the exact same story. A good mate of mine, actually, and I think I've known him for about, I want to say, 5 years. And within those 5 years, he's had multiple stints back in the hospital for having recurring psychosis and stuff. One of the last times, I've actually seen him in a while though, and it's funny like how a relationship would be like, he'd literally call me or message me on social media like every 2 weeks without a doubt, we'd have a yarn. And it got to about the second week, nothing, third week, nothing. I go, I'll just check in with your sister, see how he's going. I go, sis, how's your brother going? Haven't heard from him. Can you let me know if he's going all right? Because, at this stage, in our friendship, like I know how we go, how things go for him and stuff. And he goes, I'll just have a chat to mum and dad. Nothing. She comes back and goes, no, we haven't heard from him now. So everybody started getting worried and stuff. So, me and my partner, we rang up some places like Murray Watch and some of the watch houses that we could call. They did the same thing. And luckily, their father, Unc, would visit prisons. Mm. And, then they eventually found that, he was locked up. And, funny, actually, well, not funny, I was walking here in West End and, a publican just said, I saw your friend the other week. He wasn't, because we would usually, go to a bar, he'd get juice. Mm. This time, he got a bit of he had some alcohol. And then, he had an argument with some of the guards and things just escalated from there, instead of sort of, like the response to that automatically was, you had to call the police and, it's sad because I've been around him a few times where things have sort of escalated and we've calmed, we've sort of dealt with the situation. Then, it's very hard to sort of be in those positions. Well,
it's hard for people in the public, but also I think it's a lot to expect a police officer to do when that's not what they're trained to do as well. And sometimes they come along and they're fantastic. Yeah, look, well,
defending police.
I'm making a point.
They've got an article in the Courier Mail.
I'm making a point that, these police officers that show up, even for people that say, that some of them are good, some of them are good.
Should they be held accountable for their...
But they're not best placed to deal with these issues.
Should they be held accountable for their inactions?
Absolutely.
Within sort of, when, mob...
Absolutely, but more so the people that are investing in this and putting this responsibility on police officers, why? They're not domestic violence workers. They're not, and it's a lot to put on a police officer, Even working with Logan Police, for us to do a co-responder's response with aches at one point, this police officer was like, we don't want to be arresting these young people. We don't want... And they're just not... That's not their remit to be taking young people away and dealing with their underlying issues that are sending them there. They're there to lock them up, and essentially that's re-traumatizing them and adding to the stress. So, I think that's interesting. But just after the break, we're going to be yarning with our big boss, Jai, who before being a CEO and doing a whole range of other things, he worked in the system. So, Maggie, it's been amazing yarning with you.
Well, I think you're going to stick around?
You're going to stick around?
Yeah, I'm
stick around for the whole show.
Yeah,
look
well
at me trying to get rid of you. Well, you've requested a song, and so we'll quickly go to Yothu Yindi with Treaty.
We'll be right back. Hey, you mob. Reminder that the IUIH home support team are still here and we are still checking in with our clients on a weekly basis. You might be feeling disconnected from your community due to isolation, or maybe you're struggling to do daily tasks such as grocery shopping or household chores. Remember, our team are able to support you with the following: one-on-one visits with the home support staff member, delivery of fresh cooked meals, keeping you engaged with your clients and appointments, and connecting you with the social health team. If you are a carer and your client is part of the IUIH home support program and you wish to speak with someone in regards to the client or you have general concerns, you can call 1800 802 265 and you'll be connected with one of our friendly staff.
A message from the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health.
Station sponsor.
And that was another.
This is Bo Spearham and Karina Hogan with Let's Talk.
See what happens when I'm in charge of the panelling? I always stuff things up. No, that's all right. I'm still learning. Don't, Baba. That was Yothu Yindi with Treaty. And before the break, we were yarning with Maggie Munn, who is a fierce activist and
writer.
She's done a whole range of things and was part of a panel looking at dismantling systems last night. And today we're talking about Anastasia Palaszczuk coming out and making or pledging an historic boost to police numbers. And we're asking why what are the alternatives to policing, and why is it that all this confrontation that's happened around policing and understanding the importance around defunding police has been almost sort of like falling upon deaf ears, or it definitely seems to be in some respects.
So, and for people just sort of catching up on the conversation, on Sunday the 27th of September, Queensland Prime Minister announced a $624 million five-year investment deal, or whatever you want to call it, with QPS, Queensland Police Service. That's going to, have a huge amount of sort of impact investment into, over 1,400 frontline officers, 25 mobile police beats, vans, more regional officers in different communities outside of major cities as well. And even the Queensland Police Commissioner mentioned it's a huge number, and I'm so proud that we're funding this. It's fully funded. It's police right across Queensland, the largest number that we have seen in 30 years. The staff increase follows recommendations, by the Queensland Police Commissioner, and who said it was extraordinarily historic announcement. At the beginning of the program, I said who was in power 30 years ago, and that would have been around the 80s, just towards the end of the Joe era, where we saw, where we hear stories of the 1982 Commonwealth Games protest, we hear stories of, queer activists' doors getting kicked down and them getting hit with the Mental Health Act, I think it was back in the days, to sort of have access to their house or just to harass queer, black, anybody who was sort of left of sort of who was sort of seen as an activist or a nuisance back in those days as well. Like lots of these police powers were used against them as well. But, we did say we was going to have two guests, but we actually have our second guest here now, and we'll chat to our third guest very shortly. Our second guest is our CEO, Joe Launton. Good morning, brother. How are you going?
Good morning. It's great to be here.
And can we start by getting you to tell us who your mob is and where you're from?
Yeah, so a bit of a mob from central west Queensland there, and been down this way now for my second adopted home.
And we got you on today because we're talking about this funding that the Premier has announced, and you have actually worked in the youth prison system. Tell us about what you did there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think firstly, let's be really clear that it's no coincidence that this announcement is made when it's made. We're leading up to election next month. It's the public court of opinion is wins votes, and that's precisely why this announcement has happened. Not because of any evidence, not because of any research, and not because of anything other than political agenda, and that's why we've seen the announcement. And so what I've done. My previous roles, I suppose, I've worked in started out working in residentials with mob that have been, you know, taken away from their families.
Oh, ResiCare.
ResiCare, yeah. Then moved into youth justice, working in the youth detention centres as a youth worker, working the program space with you there, Beau, and then, yeah, sort of coordinated the programs in there, actually worked as a transition officer, and then moved into central office in a more policy-based role there, working on ways and, you know, having these conversations now around what are the alternatives to to the current forms of crime and punishment that we're currently dishing out now.
And what do you think about $624 million being pumped into increasing the number of police and police force?
Yeah, look, like I said, it's a straight political gesture, really. And that's, you know, unfortunately, there are people's lives at stake here, you know, Aunty Sherry and all those others that have lost their lives as a result to this sort of stuff. And also, you know, there's faces to these stats that's heartbreaking to see when you walk into a youth detention centre and you know the stats around mob getting overrepresented in there, but it's even more heartbreaking to see the amount of black faces on a day-to-day basis that you would walk in there and see. It breaks your heart.
Mm.
Well, you know, you working in there for quite some time. We were chatting actually off air, you know, upstairs, you know, and also, you know, there's been sort of massive campaigns as well around the country at the beginning of, you know, in the middle of this year to raise the age, you know, of criminal responsibility, which is 10 years old, you know, to sort of stop, you know, not having kids on remand while in there as well. From your experience in there as well, and you see sort of, you know, the response that, you know, at the moment with sort of, you know, what Palaszczuk sort of wants to do and wants to sort of, you know, do with the police. What's sort of your, you know, response to that from sort of being somebody who's worked with young fellas who have sort of been affected by sort of the justice system?
Yeah, I think we need to take the evidence that sits around this sort of stuff a lot more seriously so that it doesn't become a political game. I mean, when a bridge breaks, we call an engineer. When COVID happens, we're talking to chief health officers and doctors. And when there's a pandemic right now in regards to over-representation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the youth justice system or in the justice system more broadly, evidence gets thrown out the window and it just becomes a political game. And so I think we need to... And every bit of evidence that that sits around this sort of stuff conflicts with the recent announcement from the Premier. I mean, it talks about, you know, you've got different models of reform around justice reinvestment. You've got some good stuff that's happening right now in the community. There's Brisbane ATSICs just here in Brisbane are getting funded for a youth diversionary program to get young mob out of the city. So that's, again, redirecting
resources.
And
that's been really successful, Jai.
Yeah, it has been, you know, and that's where youth justice, in some regard, understand their role, and their role sometimes is redirecting resources and stuff like that back to community, because who's best suited to deal with community responses? Well, it's community. And that's exactly what reforms like justice reinvestment do. I worked on a project just as I was leaving youth justice on working with the Cherbourg community, understanding what justice reinvestment actually might even look like in the Cherbourg community, whether that was something that the community was even interested in. So, yeah, so, and I mean, you know, those sorts of, you know, there's cultural healing models, there's all sorts of different things that, cultural healing model was actually one of the last things I proposed when I left youth justice as well, and I hear now it's starting to get, you know, get the dust brushed off the paperwork and coming back to the forefront. But again, you know, we need to look at the evidence that surrounds this stuff, and that's what it comes down to.
Well, that's interesting because we've spoken with Maggie Nunn, who is a fierce activist and also studied law as well. You yourself have studied criminology and you're the CEO here at a community-controlled organisation. And we're about to bring into the conversation Professor of Criminology at the University of Technology, Sydney, Chris Kinnean. He's also the author or the writer of Defunding the Police Could Bring Positive Change in Australia. These communities are showing the way. And that piece is up on the conversation. And he wrote that earlier at about June 10, 2020. So if you jump on, you can have a look at that. But good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fantastic. So we've been yarning about something that's, I suppose, probably not so fantastic in our series Let's Talk Beyond Power and Control for the last 6 or so months. Beau and I have been picking apart these institutions and looking at alternatives to things like prisons or ways to take power and control back. But here in Queensland, the Premier, Anastasia Palaszczuk, has pledged a historic boost to police numbers, saying that the government would commit $624 million, $625.4 million investment over 5 years. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, it's what's happening in other states as well. Yeah, despite the Black Lives Matter movement, despite the calls for defunding the police, or at least looking at the way police are being funded, New South Wales government just did the same thing. $4.4 billion. 1,500 new recruits, the biggest increase to New South Wales police in the last 30 years. You know, and there's been some similar examples overseas, and so it's a real problem that, you know, right at this historic moment when people are questioning the role of the police, questioning about whether we can spend the money more wisely, you know, governments are just throwing more money at something that we know doesn't work very well at all, particularly for Aboriginal people and other racial minorities.
Yeah. I just saw, I think it was a Guardian article briefly this morning or yesterday, and it was saying at the height of COVID in Victoria, it was African and Aboriginal communities were being targeted with fines as well. You know, we see this sort of over-policing happening regardless of whether sort of how much money is getting pumped into sort of, you know, police services in different states and territories. You know, at the beginning of all this COVID stuff, I remember sort of, I think I was chatting with, it was either yourself, it was Samantha Lee from the Redfern Legal Centre about strip searches as well. You know, like there's all these sort of, you know, different sort of police powers that sort of come into play. Yeah, irregardless of sort of how much money is sort of getting pumped in. But I guess, you know, when we talk about money, we're talking about more people on the ground as well to sort of continue these things.
Now, Chris, you wrote a piece, Defunding the Police Could Bring Positive Change in Australia. These communities are showing the way. Can you tell us about some of these communities? I know you mentioned cities like Minneapolis, New York and Los Angeles. Can you tell us a little bit about how they've been working through or processing the defunding police, and, you know, have they, is it being successful?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's something that's really just started this year, yeah, coming out of the mass protest in the US around, like centered around the Black Lives Matter movement. But yeah, New York police have cut their budget. LAPD as well has had their budget cut, and Minneapolis, the city there, disbanded the city police. And there's other examples, Oregon, I think, as well, have cut back the funding for their police. It's a bit different in the US to when we talk about defunding the police, only because, you know, the US has something like 17,000 police services. It's not centralised the way it is here. So New York City or Los Angeles have their own police service. You've then got state police services. And so it'd be like, you know, if you could imagine, you know, Cairns City Police, Townsville City Police, Rocky City Police, Brisbane City Police, and then the Queensland Police on top of that. I mean, that gives you some idea of what the system is like in the US. So in some ways, it's kind of easier to think about it in the US because you've got, let's say, yeah, if it was the same example in Australia, you'd have the Cairns City Council sitting down saying, well, look, you know, we've got X number of dollars for our city. How much are we going to spend on school? How much are we going to spend on the local hospital? How much are we going to spend on the police? And so, you know, you've got much more localised decision-making there. I'm not saying that it's not appropriate in Australia to think about this. It is, definitely. But the structure in the US is pretty different around policing, around police organisation than what it is here. And I think it's probably easier to make those decisions at a local level than it is at a state level. And we've only got state police here as well as the federal police.
I mean, either way that you look at it, it's interesting when you compare it because it seems as though those people on the ground in America, USA, are sort of listening to the people. Over here, it's almost the opposite. You know, we've had people march the streets about Ani Sherry passing away in Brisbane. And let me just also say, if this has caused any distress to people listening, please contact 1311 14, which is Lifeline. I just want to make sure that I put that one in there. But I feel as though over there it's sort of being listened to. Over here it's like we've come out about Annie Sherry. We're talking about black deaths in custody. Thousands and thousands of people march the streets of Australia on the 6th of June in 2020 to say stop killing black people. But yet our Premier almost comes out and spits in the face of that and says, let's invest more money into policing the country when we know evidence shows that it does the opposite of building communities and building safety.
I remember, I think it was 2013, in Logan, an average woman, I was tasered in the eye by a police officer. And like not even a week later, there was a rally organised by a local mob in Logan, you know, for her, marched from her house to the police station. And when the march got there, literally all these police officers had their tasers hanging from their necks, from their belts, and, you know, it was real visible that, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's just real sickening that, you know, like the sister girl, I think, you know, is permanently blind, I think, you know, from that.
Yeah, well, yeah. Chris, what would you do with $624 million? Where would you put it?
Well, we can think about lots of more productive workplaces where it could be put. I mean, we're talking specifically about Murray communities, and clearly the money could go into developing community safety initiatives in Murray communities, whether that's community safety patrols, whether it's better diversionary options that are available that are community-run, community-controlled for kids. I mean, if we're thinking about it outside of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community, we can think about services for people with mental health issues that don't involve police responses. We know that lots of people, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, that die at the hands of police are in a crisis situation where police are responding to what's essentially a mental health crisis. I mean, we know that there are better examples around where you can have crisis intervention teams that don't involve the police. We can have better support for women that are escaping domestic violence. Again, you know, it's a situation where people you know, may be killed by police. So there's lots of different areas where we could think about spending that money, which would have be much more productive in terms of community development, community control, than simply, you know, approaching the problem with a hammer, you know, with an iron fist, which is basically what we do now.
Chris, with this money that has been promised here, and as you said, in other states, it's been a bit similar, I have noticed that discussion has been built around the country, and I feel as though there has been, it feels as though there has been steps forward made in understanding the importance of investing in alternatives. Are there any other things that you think are happening that are stepping in a more positive direction? You know, is there optimism out there that we could move away from this force, this hammer-down approach, and move towards investing in people and communities?
Yeah, look, I think there is. I mean, there's lots of different examples. I mean, one area that I've been involved in is around justice reinvestment, and there's lots of Aboriginal communities now in Australia, across Australia, from, you know, Halls Creek to Bourke, you know, that are looking at justice reinvestment as a way of firstly organising the community, then thinking about how the money is being spent, and then thinking about what better ways that the money could be spent in terms of actually, you know, providing some productive and effective responses within the community. And so, yeah, Bourke is probably the most well-known example.
Give us an example. Yeah. Let us know what happens there in Bourke. What happens there as far as justice reinvestment is concerned?
Yeah, well, look, the community spent a long time developing a process, really. They set up a tribal council to reflect the different kinship groups within Bourke. So it was a representative body of people in Bourke. They looked at what the key problems were in terms of kids and adults coming into the justice system. They brought together, they actually, you know, had support by the local police, which was great. And they looked at effective alternatives. They set up a driver's licensing program. They set up an alternative way for warrants to be executed so people didn't have to go into custody. Yeah, there's a whole range of different things that they did. And the impact of that was to really reduce the number of people going into custody, reduce offending by young people. And also, really importantly, other sort of side effects were things like the school retention rate for kids in Bourke has gone up. There's more kids staying in school. So I think, you know, it's about a community response. It doesn't only involve the criminal justice system. You know, it's much broader than that. I think it's a great example of community taking control. And I think, you know, we're seeing kind of other attempts to do the same. Well, other communities working on the same thing. They just haven't been doing it as long as Bourke. Halls Creek in the Kimberleys have set up a program there, programs there around identifying the key problems in relation to young people.
Just really quickly as well, Chris, so when looking at sort of, you know, the justice system or sort of, you know, implementing sort of programs to prevent sort of community members, you know, reoffending, it's really about sort of, you know, getting everybody in the community involved in like sort of in this process as well, not just sort of focusing in on sort of the supposed perpetrator of these crimes. It's looking at sort of, like, I guess holistically, you know, how to sort of, you know, how can sort of community be a part of sort of something bigger?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And that's got to be the starting point. You know, you've got to, the example of Burke was really, the very first step was to bring the community together and set up a process so that, you know, some groups didn't feel left out or felt that, you know, some groups were controlling the situation kind of thing. So it was really about establishing a mechanism, a way in which people could come together to decide what the problems were and then decide the best way to...
Well, there's actually a documentary that was written about Burke.
What,
I know you've got
called?
You've got a take-off right now, but it's called From Burke with Love, and it's children in a remote Aboriginal community of Burke uncover their town's hidden stories of civil rights activism. I think that might be it.
I think there's another one as well about... Like,
in 2018.
But, Chris, we do have to say goodbye to you. Because we know you're busy. But then also for our listeners who are tuning in via NERS, if you want to continue to listen to the rest of this program, we're going to go a minute or two over.
Jump on
our website, 989fm.com.au, because you can listen to it there. Or you can pick the podcast up a little bit later on after that. Thanks, Chris, for chatting with us this morning. We'd love to
definitely
have you back
on
the program.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
And that was Chris Kinnean. He's a professor of criminology down at the University of Sydney. And we're still joined by Jai and Maggie. And yeah, I think you know, it's an interesting thing to look at when we talk about things like power and control, Jai. You know, you've worked with young people, and this justice reinvestment stuff in Burke, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, investing in communities rather than investing in prisons. You know, just from your experience of knowing these young mob that you worked with back then, you know, how important do you think it is that we sort of change what's happening and how it is that we're approaching these underlying issues that these young mob are facing, you know, some of them being 10 years old?
Yeah, it's super important. I think, you know, when you look at, you know, the costs alone and a cost to have to hold a young person in detention for one day is $1,600 and... That's where the investment is pointed. It's at, you know, at the pointy end of the scale in incarceration and in police, and that's why. And justice reinvestment is only one model out there. That's and it's based on a model over in the US. And I would think that
that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I and it's because there is an evidence base around it. But I think there's also, there's some other models out there that could be explored that are much more effective and efficient than what we're looking at now. Because what we're looking at now and what we're measuring is, I'm not too sure what we're measuring. Because if we're measuring recidivism, then we're perpetuating a problem that's never going to be solved. And you know and so I think that's where the money does have to be, you know, reinvested into community, where community are able to articulate, well, what are the needs and how do we invest in those needs? This model within itself is not a new way of thinking. This model in itself is driving right back down to, you know, giving community control. It's a very simple concept that we need to move towards.
It's interesting because even like here at 98.9, we put massive emphasis on the importance of working with our young fellas in the training centre. And, you know, you see the hard work that they do, and when you invest in them, you know, you see when they're giving back how deadly the work it is that they do. You know, like, you know, I even know myself growing up in a chaotic and difficult environment, you know, I was really lucky that I had key people in my life that, you know, really helped and pulled me through some of those situations. Had that not happened, I don't know that I'd be sitting here behind the microphone, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to touch on a really good local initiative that probably the most effective initiative that I was ever a part of in this whole time is a program called Who Am I that was facilitated by Brother John Tapau. And you know, when we talk about what we measured on, and it was around not only that young person, but that young person's family. And by family, it wasn't always biological family, but his, the people that surrounded him and him or her. And, yeah, that program really did a deep dive into who that person was and what the events led up to them being in, being locked up. And it was a real, it was a great initiative. And, you know, a handful of them young fellas never ever saw the inside of the bars again. And that's what we need to be measuring ourselves on. And that's the sort of initiatives we need to be funding. And so, yeah, big shout out to Brother John. And
definitely, we'll have to get him on and have a yarn to him about that. And it is amazing, like, I think even working at Sisters Inside, sometimes when you work with women who are provided those basic things that you need, just to, you know, safety, housing, all those types of things, you know, the difference that that type of stuff can make, you know, and especially with young mob, you know, I don't want to see, there's some of these prisons, these young detention centres have 100% Indigenous people in them. Like, this is happening today, right now as we sit here. And I think that's a blight on Australia. And I think it's a blight that we continue to look at ways to continue and perpetuate that cycle. But I think we'll just continue to talk about it, you know. Maggie, what would you like to see happen moving forward as someone that's worked in this space?
Yeah, I think, you know, the investment in communities, you know, can't be understated. When mob have control over mob issues, shit gets done.
Yeah.
You know, and I think who better to lead, you know, communities than people who have firsthand experience at what issues, you know, face those communities. So investment in those communities is the most important thing. We need to step away from the reliance on police and prisons to, you know, fix problems or to address problems, because we've seen time and time again that that doesn't work. You know, and time and time again, it's people of colour and First Nations folk who are over policed and overrepresented in, you know, court cases, in, you know, behind bars, all of those sorts of things, you know, and we need to step away from relying on the systems that have oppressed us from day dot, you know, when they got here. And
this notion that policing equals safety.
Exactly. That's bogus, you know, and we know that. It doesn't work. It never has worked. And like Brother said, you know, if we're measuring recidivism rates, we know that that's not an appropriate way to do it. So instead we need to start looking to building sustainable, you know, justice programs that are actually focused on addressing the needs and the root causes of those conditions and those behaviours.
And if you'd like to share your experience around being in the criminal justice system, you can jump on our Facebook page and inbox us at 989FM. We'd love to hear from you, hear about your experience, because it's important that we speak to their mob as well, people with lived experience,
but then,
isn't it?
There's ones that are not on parole because they can get in trouble as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk to us.
We can't broadcast.
Legally, we probably can't broadcast this, but it's been a fascinating chat today. Thanks so much for joining us here in the studio, Jai and Maggie. We're going to continue yarns around this stuff in the future, but you've both added so much to this conversation. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And that was Maggie Munn and Jai Launton, the
and
big
also
boss.
Chris Canini
and
as well.
Chris Canine. Yes, the professor of criminology. Fascinating chat today, Bo.
It was a really good conversation. I guess in the light of sort of that announcement by Palaszczuk needed to happen as well, and I'm sure, you know, there's people in the community that are having these conversations that we've had today as well. So it's good to sort of add to sort of, you know, these conversations of sort of the alternative to sort of just policing and more powers and, you know, more boots on the ground or vans or whatever, you know, it's good
stop,
to sort of...
Stop wasting money, like just throwing money away. I mean, this is taxpaying dollars. Like, well, you and I both pay these taxpaying dollars, and I think I'd like to see change in the system so that, you know, that these things aren't occurring, and that we're living in a safer community, you know, a happier, safer, more just, equal community. Because we know that countries like America that have some of the biggest injustices in the world have the highest prison population as well. You know, it kind of comes hand in hand, right? I don't want to move in that direction. I don't know about you know, other people, but I definitely don't want to move in that direction. So
definitely. If you've enjoyed the program this morning, you can catch the repeat at 7 p.m. tonight or go to our website at 989fm.com.au. and a program is podcast. So you can catch that a little bit later on our website, or head to Spotify or Apple Podcast to stream them. And as always, it has been a pleasure. You're listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM.